Benfong Torres, almost famous since 1969. What the heck?
What the heck, indeed. To be with you, Kat.
It's an honor to have you on. Producer Kim and I are mutually starstruck, and I know you're just a regular guy, but starting radio back in the 80s, we lived and died regarding whether or not we were in the Pink Section's Radio Waves column, whether we were mentioned by Benfong Torres back in the day.
What stations were you at?
I was on Live 105. I did traffic for them with Alex Bennett with that crazy morning show.
Yeah, that was a good show. That was a tremendous stage for comedians, both local and national.
It was amazing. Hey, what was your first big break? We'll get into all the amazing things that you've done, but you went to San Francisco State. You got a degree in radio, TV, and film. When did you start working in your beloved field?
Well, strangely enough, the first gig was in radio, and it was after I had left SF State, and it was a friend, I suppose, who was programming KFOG.
Mm.
And this is 1967 we're talking about. This is the Summer of Love. And so Jack was the PD, and he reached out to me because he knew I had left SF State, and he knew I was interested in radio, and he knew me kind of from high school, where he had been commissioner of assemblies a couple of years before me, and so he figured I might be able to do this all-night job on KFOG, which was a beautiful music station at the time, or easy listening or something, and it was just to run tapes from a sponsor and break in a couple of times an hour doing headlines and weather, and writing continuity while the music was playing. And so that was my first thing, was all night at Ghirardelli Square in San Francisco for KFOG. And then the first break in terms of Rolling Stone would be, I suppose, just a little later that year when Rolling Stone started publishing in late 1967. And early in 68, a roommate of mine who was involved in the entertainment industry, he was kind of a road manager for Albert Grossman, who had Peter, Paul, and Mary, and Jimi Hendrix, and a few others, Dylan. And so he said, hey, there's this band coming into town to do a free concert just down the block on Steiner Street for Dick Clark's Haight Ashbury movie. And I thought, what? Does Rolling Stone know about this? That's the first thing that popped into my mind, of course. And so I telephoned the office, and they said, no, we don't know about it. That sounds interesting. Mr. American Bandstand doing a movie about the hippies. So I went down there and got the item and sent it in, and that opened the door. And so by early spring of 68, I had my first articles going in, and I think that they, in part, were coverage of the labor strike at KMPX, the first freeform FM rock station, at least on the West Coast. And so I began covering that and became a byline in Rolling Stone. And
How old were you at that time?
Well, you see now, in 68, I would be 23.
Oh, my gosh. And it the right place at the right time, and you called them, and there you
were. Yeah, that's it.
That's amazing. So you were 20. Yeah. You were in your 20s in San Francisco during the Summer of Love. That is this iconic era, and you were there. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, as it turns out, Kat, I'm now working on a musical that is centered on that time frame, and the producers said Summer of Love is the title, and I told them, yeah, but the Summer of Love began for many of us maybe a year and a half or two before. In 65, the spirit was already there, and the people were already beginning to coalesce and gather and resist and all the stuff that was going on, both politically and socially and culturally and musically, sexually. All that was happening already in San Francisco and the Bay Area. And so for me, the time frame will be sort of maybe a bit of 65, a lot of 66, and then finally crashing into the media barrage of 1967 and the Monterey Pop Festival and then the invasion of the Haight-Ashbury by thousands of people, including runaways and weekend hippies. It was really quite a mix of humanity. and quite a phenomenon socially. And obviously, we have been kind of marking the 50th anniversary of it, especially last year. And so now I get to the challenge of trying to create a semi-fictional dramatization of it for a musical stage with original songs primarily. But I think I can get the producers to spring for a couple of the anthems of the times, like maybe a Jimi Hendrix or an Airplane or the song Get Together, some stuff like that to mix into the pot.
So when is when can we expect to maybe hear and see that musical?
Never. It's never.
It's not never, an answer.
It is never soon enough for you?
No.
It's the beginning of the process, Kat.
Okay. So I'm excited, Ben.
Such a long shot that you never know, but you got to give it a shot. So
absolutely.
That's what I'm doing right now.
All right. I'm looking at some of the people you interviewed while you were at Rolling Stone. Bob Dylan, let's see, you've covered Bob Dylan, The Stones, Ray Charles, Paul McCartney, The Jackson 5, Elton John, Stevie Wonder, Bonnie Raitt, the list goes on and on and on. Do you have one or two absolutely, for good or bad reasons, memorable interviews that were just epic or went horribly sideways?
Well, at my age, it's hard to remember anything, even the memorable ones. But at bookstores and other appearances, I have been asked that question and have always responded with two people. It's kind of maybe three. It's kind of odd because none of them is a rock and roll star.
Hmm.
So I generally tend toward Ray Charles, partly because that was in the early 70s, I think it was. And with Ray, the thing was that the idea came from just me. It was not from the charts. It was not from anything he was doing on, a tour. It was just that he was Ray Charles. And so I made that point at an editorial meeting, and they said, yeah, sure, I see he's in town for a blues festival or a jazz festival or something, so let me go chase after him, see what's going on, and see if there's a story. And it wound up being a Rolling Stone interview that won a magazine writing award, and it was the first time that Ray allowed himself to discuss more candidly his problems with hard drugs. And so it was an achievement, and I ascribe it to Ray Charles. And the other one was Marvin Gaye.
Really?
After his landmark album, What's Going On, I went to visit him at his home and in various spots in and around Detroit, and just found this incredibly insecure, vulnerable guy who was just not at all sure what might happen next. He had no clue. He knew that he had done a great job on What's Going On, but just had no idea. And that was a shock to me to find an artist who should be on top of the world sitting there just kind of nervous about what might happen and being so candid about it.
Interesting.
That's how things were back then. And then my third one that I think of as a favorite is the actor Diane Keaton.
Really?
Who I had admired from a distance for some years. And especially after she had done Annie Hall with Woody Allen, and she had just made one of the worst movies in her career, something about Looking for Mr. Goodbar.
Oh gosh!
But that didn't matter to me. The idea of hanging out with Diane
right.
in New York was fantastic, and not only did she give a tremendous interview during our visit, but said, "You know, I'm not that good talking about myself. You really should talk to Woody." And so she got on her kitchen phone and. Called Woody Allen, and he said, yeah, okay, sure, he can come over. And so then I jumped into a cab and went across town and visited with Woody Allen for probably about an hour talking about Diane Keaton and the movies. So that was a thrill back then.
That is
so
awesome.
Those are mine. But sure, Dylan, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Linda Ronstadt, being on a bus with Bonnie Raitt, Tom Waits, and John Prine. It's pretty hard to top some of those experiences. And with Elton John, it was a Learjet. You know, those
of
are the
course
days.
It was.
Yeah.
Did you ever get starstruck? I mean, you did it for so long, and these are these people. But to your point, Marvin Gaye, this insecure, quiet fellow, did you ever get starstruck because it was someone that you sort of idolized because of your love of music?
It was situational with Marvin. He was just so down to earth from the very, very first hello that I forgot that I had been hearing him for 10 years before, you know, the early Motown hits with Tammy Terrell or I'll Be Doggone and all that stuff that I listened to as a kid, just digging R&B. And so, but with someone like Mick Jagger, I think you couldn't help but be in some way awestruck by that. And so with Mick, I think I felt it. With Paul McCartney, no. With Bob Dylan, no. With Dylan, you know, he was very difficult. But we had met, I was still chasing after him to have him commit to an interview in the early part of his tour of, I think, 1974. And so I had to pretty much physically chase him down myself. And thank God, after one of the first concerts, I think it was in Philadelphia, Robbie Robertson, I found out where the band was staying in terms of what floor they were hanging out on. So I went there, and Robbie said, yeah, Bob's in there right now. So I went into this larger room and just sat down next to him and said, hey, sort of asking him, how he was doing, and can we have an interview? And he knew that I was there from Rolling Stone and that there had been a request made already. So he said, yeah, okay, so tomorrow, we'll do that.
Oh, gosh.
In the next city, whatever it was, in like Montreal. And so we sat down, but then he looked at my tape recorder and said, no, no recording. And so I had to suddenly switch from one mode of transcription to another. And writing furiously fast in front of Bob Dylan while trying to maintain some kind of eye contact was not the easiest thing to do in the world.
Wow. So that was
but
the one.
It came out all right.
We're going to have you do your Elvis imitation at some point during this little chat as well, sir. But so Bob Dylan was the one that almost got away. Are there any people that you, even with the name Rolling Stones behind you, Rolling Stone magazine, anybody that you were unable to interview that you just didn't get a chance to talk to in your career?
I would say that the main one might be Carole King. We got her later on. Cameron Crowe got her. And I think another one that we should have had was Janis Joplin. And that was sadly just a case of her own sensitivity to the reviews that were written about her, not only around the country, but particularly Rolling Stone, which she considered to be a hometown paper for her. And so when Rolling Stone attacked her for her concerts or didn't like an album or dissed Big Brother and the holding company as being an inferior backup band or whatever, she took it pretty hard. And so she never did a Rolling Stone interview, even though there were certainly many times that we could have done that. So the only time that I had contact with her was a strange night after midnight in Chinatown, where I did occasional volunteer work for a bilingual newspaper called East West. So I was down in this grungy basement office, and the phone rang, and this editor, Ken, answered and said, oh, Ben, I think it's for you. It's Janis Joplin.
Jeez.
So I picked up the phone, and it was Janis, and she was responding to a request I had made for information about a visit she had done in Brazil, I think, and about her new band and like that. And she was in a mood to talk. So we chatted for about 15, 20, 30 minutes, I don't know. Of course, I didn't record it because there was no plan for any such thing.
Right.
So once again, I was just scribbling like a madman and did a little story that was headlined informally the way Rolling Stone did. Mm-hmm. The headline was, hey, Janis is feeling great. And that was it. It was just a few paragraphs about her trip to Brazil, her new tattoos, her new girlfriend, her new boyfriend, stuff like that.
Done.
And that was about as close as we got to a Rolling Stone interview with Janis.
That is awesome. Have to ask you about one of your colleagues at Rolling Stone magazine, the one and only Hunter S. Thompson. What was it like working with that character?
Well, it was like having a rock star in the room, you know, sort of. And it wasn't as if he comported himself that way or tried to flash any kind of a status or role with us. He was just who he was, and he did things the way he did them. And it was outsized and crazed, and But by and large, he delivered, especially in the early going with Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, later on covering campaigns, political campaigns, and other stories. He began to falter, and it was a combination of just excessive living and brutal deadlines imposed by Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone. But it became a kind of a comedy trying to get him to meet a deadline and turn in copy. And
that's awesome.
So, then you also saw both sides of Hunter. You know, and when he was at the office or attending a party or something, then you could also see the rather quiet, shy side. I know that's hard to imagine Hunter Thompson being, but as with most people who become performers and who acknowledge that they're in a field that is pretty much akin to entertainment, even though you come to it from being a journalist, you learn to play both sides for your own good, so that on stage he would, like Janis, he would swig from a bottle of whiskey, partly because he wanted to, and partly because he knew that that was kind of what was expected of him. Mm-hmm. You know, he had a brand now. He had an image to live up to or live down to, and so he would do that, and it wasn't always to his own best interests.
So, Ben, you have written for all kinds of amazing magazines. You have written books. You have written for newspapers. You have done radio. You have done television. You sing at senior homes, for God's sake. What is there still on your to-do list?
Finish this stupid musical.
There, you heard it. It's going to finish and not be never. It's good. You're going to finish it at some point, yeah?
I'm going to finish it one way or another until they tell me to stop.
That's awesome. I will need to hear your Elvis impersonation, please.
Well, what kind of sound do you want?
Oh, I don't know. It's Ben Fong Torres' choice. Channeling
Elvis. Well, I did one last night with a jam band. I had been doing Can't Help Falling in Love and Love Me. Treat me like a fool. Treat me mean and cruel, but love me for a long, long time. And then recently I had occasion to do Little Sister with a band at a fundraiser. And that kind of woke me up to the fact that I had been doing too much ballads of Elvis's, and I should pump up the tempo. So Little Sister was fun to learn and do, and then last night I did the old Treat Me Nice.
Let's hear it a little bit.
Well, I walk through that door, baby, be polite. You're gonna make me sore if you don't greet me right. Don't you ever kiss me once, kiss me twice, treat me nice.
Very, okay. Very nice. Okay, so did you ever... No, you did not do Bob Dylan for Bob Dylan because he was cranky, but how long have you been singing? Has it been something that you've... Well, look at the world that you've lived in. Has it always been a thing with you?
It's always been a thing, and thinking back to Rolling Stone, we had a occasional gathering of staff members for what was called a no-talent show, and so I began to perform there, and I did Dylan back then. I wrote a song when Howard Cohn and David Weir did the SLA Sensational Scoop, and I did a song to the tune of a tune that Dylan wrote about Hurricane Carter. It was the ballad of the SLA, and performed it at a local nightclub called The Boarding House, where actually Diane and I have seen many, many wonderful shows. Mm-hmm. And there we were doing a Bob Dylan tune with a band. So I've been doing Dylan for a long time, and for the past probably 10 or 12 years, almost every month I write a song to the tune of Rainy Day Women 12 and 35, Everybody Must Get Stoned, to the headlines of the day.
That's awesome.
And so, last night it was our jam night, so I did do one with a lot of stuff about the New York Times op-ed.
Yes,
and how people were all denying having done it, and a few other things. This pretty much just ripped from the headlines.
You have
so I do that.
Very fertile mind, I would say. You have to keep it busy in some capacity with things like this.
Yeah.
What are you most proud of? Can you focus, can you hone it down to a couple of accomplishments in your amazing career and life that you're most proud of?
No, I really can't. There's a documentary being made of me by Suzanne Jo Kai. Maybe she can do the honing. I can just phone it in.
Pare it down to two good hours.
Ryan Hone and phone. no, I think, now that you asked that, and you mentioned the variety of media and interests, I suppose that what I'm most proud of is that I was able to, in my own small way, follow along the lines of one of my boyhood idols, who was Steve Allen. He was a pioneer, a late night talk show host. He was also a comedian. He was also a jazz pianist. He was also a composer. He also acted in the Benny Goodman story and elsewhere. He did comedy skits. And I had a chance to meet him when I was hosting a radio show here in San Francisco called Fog City Radio.
I remember.
And we got along tremendously. And I felt like, wow, I think as a younger person, when I was doing stuff, dabbling in print and also in radio and then later on television, I thought of him often and just said, man, if Steve can do that, have such a great time and a wonderful career and high respect, then if I had anything, even 10% of that, that would be pretty wonderful. And I think that's probably what I'm the proudest of having followed my role model, Steve Allen, and then later on Gary Owens, who was a disc jockey who also did all kinds of stuff.
Good role models.
I like that idea of being a one-person variety show.
well put. And wrapping up, the podcast is called NorCal Names. You were born in Alameda. You went to school in San Francisco. You've traveled everywhere, and yet you've called the Bay Area your home. Why Northern California? What do you love about where we live?
Well, I was born here, and so then you grow to love it, and I ascribe a lot of my pivotal moments in college and high school to being here in San Francisco and Oakland, the Bay Area in general, for its more liberal attitude towards everything. Because back when I was a kid, there were no, aside from Steve Allen, there were no role models, and certainly none among Asian Americans. You know, there was a person here and a person there. But because I was at San Francisco State, the doors were open. You know, there was no questioning that I might be interested in writing for the newspaper or then becoming editor or being a disc jockey on the radio, campus radio station, and then having my own show. And like that, and being able to be on local commercial stations that had connections to the college. So I am grateful for the area in which I was raised and educated. And so although there have been occasions when I was asked to go to New York to be part of Rolling Stone there, there's just been no reason. It's just beautiful here in so many ways. So I'm happy to stay here.
Ben Fong-Torres, an honor to talk to you. A pleasure. We heard some Dylan. We heard some Elvis. And you are truly, I'm looking forward to the documentary, because your life truly encapsulates what happened in the Bay Area through some of the most important times in the city's history, plus all the cool people you've gotten to talk to. So thanks so much for taking the time.
I appreciate it, Kat. Thank you very much.